Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's so great to see everybody today. We have, if I didn't stop you on the way in, we have two baskets from Great Harvest, so your chances of winning are double. If you want to take advantage of that, you can go to the front table there and get yourself a ticket. We're going to be pulling those in a few minutes. If you could take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program is being recorded for the radio. I'd like to thank Kari Gardy, who's doing this recording. And you can listen to this program, as well as all of our previous programs, on either our website, we'll have a link, or directly at alaskapublic.org. And we're reaching 4,000 people through this rebroadcast, and we're super excited about that. Speaking about being super excited, we also were one of the winners this year of the Governor's North Star Award for International Excellence. Along with Datum and Iceland Air, the Alaska World Affairs Council is recognized for all the things we do in the community and for our students, and we are just really thrilled. You should look at our Facebook. We have some great pictures of that event with the governor, and look forward to what's in stock. Speaking of our students, do we have any students? We would love to recognize you today. If you wouldn't mind standing if you're a student, and we'll clap. Fabulous. Thank you so very much for coming, and thank you, BP, for sponsoring our student program. For any program, they can come at no cost. And our speaker, in addition to talking to our students today, we usually ask our speaker if they'll go to a local school during the morning before our program, and our speaker today agreed to do two. So he was running around this morning. He spoke to a group of students at East High School and then at McLaughlin Youth Center and had quite a conversation about conflict resolution that is something we all could hear. And at the head table today, we have to my far left, Dr. Paul Dunscombe, who is the co-chair of our program committee. And we are really pleased for him to join us here at the head table. And to his right, I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Garrett Wong, co-chair of the board of directors, who will be introducing our speaker today. Mr. Wong.
Well, thank you, Lisa, and welcome all of you to this afternoon's presentation. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Aaron Wolf. Aaron Wolf is a professor of geography in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. Excuse me. He has an MS in Water Resources Management and a PhD in Environmental Policy Analysis from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Wolf's research focuses on issues relating to transboundary water resources to political conflict and cooperation. He has acted as a consultant on various aspects of international water resources and dispute resolutions. The list of clients include the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the World Bank. And of note, he's been involved in developing strategies for resolving water aspects of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Dr. Wolf, as we might expect, is published. He's author or editor of 7 books. The resume goes on. And involved in nearly 50 journal articles, books, and professional reports, all touching on various aspects of transboundary waters. Today, given the world sensitivity to population stress on existing water supplies, Dr. Wolf will be speaking to us on shared waters, conflicts, cooperation, and transformation. So please, let's extend Dr. Wolf a very warm Alaskan winter welcome.
Thank you so much. Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. And I got to say, I got a much fairer view than you guys. I appreciate you setting the room up this way. Although I noticed, just like freshmen, nobody likes to sit in the front row. It doesn't matter what room you're in, you will not sit in the front row. I'm reminded why I don't schedule classes just about now, because I blood sugar is going to drop. And so if you feel after you're done and you need to put your head down and rest, that's also okay. I'm used to that. Thank you for the generous introduction, and thanks to the World Affairs Council for bringing me here. It's my first trip to Alaska. I'm really enjoying it. I got to say, as Lisa mentioned, I was in two high schools this morning, and it was really exciting. It was a lot of energy in both places. And when the first time I spoke to a high school group, I didn't at the time have high school age kids, and I asked, how do you do it? I'm not quite sure my strategy here. And the principal said, well, just do what you normally do, but at a higher level. And that's pretty much what I found, is these kids were definitely engaged and would not let me get away. I hope you guys are easier on me and let me get away with everything, because I'll try. As we mentioned, I'm going to talk about the particular issue of shared waters as a political set of issues. And so we have to start understanding what the world of water resources is in general. As crises go, this is about as big as anything that we face. If you look at these numbers, 2.5 billion people lack access to sanitation. More than 1 billion people lack access to safe drinking water. And that results in 250 million people getting sick and 2.5 to 5 million people dying every year. So if you put this on order of magnitude of all of the crises that we face, this is as big as anything else out there. This is as big as malaria, and it's as big as HIV/AIDS, and it's bigger than anything else. So all the things that are capturing our attention in any given time, all the wars in any given year put together, this is bigger. Tsunamis, earthquakes, floods, all the catastrophes that we're used to dealing with, this is bigger than all of them. And the problem is, along with this as a crisis in and of itself, are the political implications that go along with it. So I'm going to ask your indulgence, and you don't have a mic, but just throw out, what do we use water for? You guys didn't know it was going to be interactive. It's like, dude, we're eating lunch. Just play. What do we use water? We're drinking water, right? Okay, so 5% of the world's water goes to drinking water.
Energy
production, absolutely. In the Northwest, it's huge. What else? Irrigation. This is the biggest use, right? 2/3 of the water, all the way in the back, sir. Living, all the different uses, right? So that's exactly right. So I had a grad student pull together some of the pictures that can bring these to life. The environment we didn't mention, absolutely critical for environmental protection. Transportation we didn't mention. I don't think this is Alaska, but could be. Hydropower we mentioned in the Northwest. This is absolutely key. Irrigation, a lot of the world's water goes to irrigation. Religious purposes, all world faith traditions tap into water for spiritual nourishment, for spiritual healing. And, of course, drinking water, which is vastly important, but a very small percentage of the water that we use. So the trick is, when we're managing water, we're managing for all of these different competing uses. Which two of these are potentially in conflict with each other? Transportation and drinking. Irrigation and drinking, all of them, all of them, all of them. That's the point. When we're managing water, we're essentially managing conflict, and this happens regardless of the size of the watershed or its location. The other problem politically with water is it moves. If you think about other resources, they have the courtesy to stay in one place. Water doesn't do this. Moves through space and time. How much water will there be in the Yukon? How much water will there be in the Yukon next year? We don't know. And yet we have to manage it just like any other resource, trying to allocate it, assuming we know something about it. Now, nature gives us a unit from the ridge to the stream, and if we look down at a map view, everything within this unit is connected to everything else. It's surface water, groundwater, quality, quantity, it's all connected. What do we call this? It's a drainage basin or a watershed or a catchment area, right? Everything's connected. And this is the way water people tend to see the world. Now, what do we do with these units in terms of political boundaries? Do we respect them? Absolutely not. The opposite. If you look, for example, at the eastern border of between Alaska and BC, that's our typical boundary. What is it? It's a nice straight line cutting these units into pieces. Now, sometimes we even use the river itself as a boundary, which sometimes can be problematic because what do rivers do? They move, right? They move over time. Sometimes that's beneficial. Any Oregonians here? Any Washingtonians here? Okay, so our border is a river, the Columbia between Oregon and Washington, which is migrating northward. So over geologic time, we will get Seattle. We will get Seattle. So this is our challenge, really. On the left is the way water people see the world, the things that unite us, the things that bring us together. On the right is the way the rest of the world sees water, the lines that divide us. And those lines are there for very legitimate reasons and need to be respected. We can't just say, oh, I wish they weren't there. The boundaries are there. Canada is different than Alaska. Israel is different than Jordan, right? These boundaries are there for very legitimate reasons, protecting all the things that are within the boundaries. Which one of these is right? Which is the correct way to view the world? Both. And that's exactly our problem. We have to manage the world as if it looked, manage the water as if it looked, as if the world looked like it does on the left, recognizing and honoring the lines that divide us up. Now let's think about some of the nations that do have to share their watersheds in order to manage the water efficiently. India and Pakistan, for example, share the Indus Basin, and India and Bangladesh share the Ganges, Brahmaputra. Headwaters of both are in China, right? How are relations there in each of these basins? Little tense, right? So let's go to a calmer basin. How about the Tigris-Euphrates? Syria, Iraq, Turkey, right? You're laughing. Out of those three countries, this is a huge watershed, hugely important to all the people there, and there's only one functioning government in that basin, right? And in fact, armies were mobilized in the late 70s on the Iraq-Syria border because of a dam that Syria wanted to put in. On the Aral Basin, there are dams going in the headwaters, causing a water conflict in one direction, a natural gas conflict going on in the other direction as a result of the breakup of the Soviet Union. And interested in both, the natural gas and the dams, let's take a look at who the neighbors are here. China's kind of interested in this area. Oh, there's Afghanistan. Remember, we got to pull all our troops and material out of Afghanistan the end of next year. Which way are we going to go? Well, it's going to be through Uzbekistan, which is wrapped up in this conflict over dams and natural gas. So when we're talking about water, oftentimes we're not just talking about water, but it's at the center, at the heartbeat of whatever other issues are swirling around the basin. Much easier than the others, the Nile, for example. Right, 11 countries. We had a brand new country in South Sudan a couple of years ago. Two countries, Egypt and Sudan, have a treaty that allocated all the water to the two of them, conveniently forgetting about the other nine. Israelis and Arabs, how are relations there? Whew, right? And here we are with the Jordan Basin and shared groundwater in between them. Every place there's a boundary between Israelis and Arabs, there's also a water dispute underlying it. So not surprisingly, people have latched on this. Here's a resource that we use for everything we do. And we're running out of it, and climate change and population growth and all these other things are happening. Clearly, the wars of the 21st century will be about water. And Kofi Annan, 13 years ago now, said this: fresh competition for fresh water may well become a source of conflict and wars in the future. How many people agree? Right? It feels intuitive. And you heard in this kind introduction, my first training was as a scientist. I was a groundwater hydrogeologist. And I got interested in this issue primarily growing up both back and forth between the Middle East and California. Both places, water underlies a lot of the politics. But as a scientist, I'm kind of looking at this and I'm thinking, gosh, those are six interesting case studies. And that's all the press, that's all the documentation that was there was about those six case studies. And I, as a scientist, you ask, well, how representative is that? Is what's going on in those six basins, what's going on in the rest of the world? And the answer is, We honestly did not know. So I want to now go back to where I got involved in the 90s. Scientists collect stuff, and that's what we started to do. I wanted to understand more broadly, not just those six case studies, but more broadly, what do we know about the world of shared water resources? And for one, we didn't even know how many international boundaries there were. People were talking about six, but there's actually 286. We took 2.5 years to make this map to figure out there's 286 basins around the world that are shared by two or more countries. That's half the land surface of the Earth. It's 40% of the world's population, and 80% of the world's water originates in basins that are shared by two or more countries. So that's interesting. If there's 286 and we're hearing about six, what's going on in the rest? Not only that, there's another 300 shared aquifers, groundwater units that are shared by two or more countries. And at the time, we weren't hearing anything at all about those. The other thing that was curious was this bottom axis is a spectrum of things that countries can do to each other or with each other. From conflict, which was what we were hearing about, to nothing, to cooperate. And so, again, the scientific question is, well, if we're hearing about these six that are conflict prone, is it possible that in the other 280, they're not all conflicting? Maybe they're doing nothing. Or maybe they're actually cooperating. And so what we started to do was to, again, we count stuff, we compile stuff, we started to compile all of the world's experience, treaties and negotiating notes, annotated bibliography. It's all online for anybody, the students can jot this down, the papers will write themselves with all the data that's up there. I literally had a student plagiarize from my own website and turn in a paper to me. I'm sorry, that just boggles. I read that and I said, wow, this is good. Hey, wait a second. Don't do that, student. So one of the things we did was go back over the last 60 years and find every instance, every recorded instance of two countries doing anything around water and compiling it and coding it along that spectrum from conflict to cooperation. So these are a couple of examples where it happened, why it happened, how intense it was, cooperatively or conflictively. And right away, we start to get a much more nuanced story. Just looking at these 1,800 events over the last 60 years, this is along that spectrum from cooperation on the right to war on the left. And the first thing you notice is that 80% of our experience with two countries over water is cooperative. Now, this is the same countries that people were holding up as examples of conflict. These are Arabs and Israelis, Indians and Pakistanis, Azeris and Armenians. And what was interesting, when you go back and you actually look with more detail at the case study, yes, there was some kind of a flashpoint that got everybody's attention, and the politicians got excited, and the press got excited, and people were predicting war, and that's when people wrote about it. And then they resolve their issue time and time again. And that's when people lost interest. And so all of this cooperation are between people who don't like each other very much. That's who signs treaties. That's who comes to work in relationships. We'll look in some detail in a bit. On the conflict side, 80% of conflictive events are verbal events. This is primarily two things. It's a politician saying there will be a war, or it's a journalist writing that there will be. Now, I know it doesn't happen in Alaska, but in some parts of the world, politicians lie. Or they say things for reasons other than scientific accuracy, right? When a politician says, we're going to go to war, the first question you ask is, who is he or she talking to, primarily? Are they even talking to the enemy? No. Who are they talking to? Their own constituents. And what does that mean, we're going to go to war? It means vote for me in November, right? So when politicians are grabbing onto this issue, it's for their own political motives, and we get that. And of course, the press, are there any press folks here? No, not now, nobody's gonna raise their hand, right? Right? I mean, that's what happens. I get calls all the time, two-hour interviews, all this cooperative history and people getting along, and oh, isn't it wonderful? And the headline invariably the next day is what? water wars on the horizon, inevitably. So on the violence side, this minus five and nine and minus six, that's 38 cases of actual violence over water between two countries. 27 of these are between Israelis and Arabs, which is interesting because the last shot fired between Israelis and Arabs over water was in 1970. So if you think of that, if you think, first of all, know that they ran out of water in 1968. Demand hit supply in 1968. That's it. They're out of water. And for the subsequent, how many years has it been since 1970? What are we, 44 years? All the population growth, two wars, three intifadas, current tension, all the things that are going on, and they resolve their water issues in the absence of violence. Now, that's really interesting. In terms of wars, that minus seven, what's that number? You can see here in the front. That's zero. Zero wars in 60 years, zero wars in 1,000 years, zero wars in 4,000 years. There's been one water war in history between the city-states of Lagash and Uma, and that was 4,500 years ago. That's it. That's our record. And that war then led to the first water treaty in history, which hangs in the Louvre for those who are interested. I know it does because I wanted to include it in a book. I had a picture of it, and the editor wrote to me. It's in cuneiform. He said, "Well, which way's up?" I said, I don't know. Right. So this now presents us with a more interesting and nuanced story about what's going on. Furthermore, once countries come to some kind of agreement, those agreements tend to hold, even as countries fight over other issues. And so the picnic table talks, this is talks that go back to the 50s between Israel and Jordan, survives two wars and become the basis for the Israel-Jordan Treaty of Peace, the water components. The Mekong Committee was established in 1957, survives Vietnam War, bombing in Cambodia, all the tumult in the Mekong Basin. The entire time they exchange water resources data to where now they're a very effective water management agency. The Indus River Commission, this was established in 1960, not only survives two wars between India and Pakistan, but in the middle of one of the wars, India made payments to Pakistan as part of their treaty obligations. And this is a really good example because since 1960, in this treaty, there are three levels of conflict resolution. And this is the pattern over and over. There's a dispute, people talk about war, people talk about, oh my gosh, they both have nukes, people get very, very nervous, and time again, they go back to their treaty and they resolve their issue precisely to the letter through the conflict resolution mechanism in the treaty. Currently in the Caucasus or in Southern Africa, oftentimes people will talk about water when they won't talk about anything else, which brings us now to myth two, well, everything's okay. We just love each other. We're all going to continue to get along. If only we shared a river, there'd be no problems anywhere in the world. And we know that's not the case. And I'd suggest there are three reasons why everything's not okay. This process from a flashpoint to negotiations takes decades, literally decades. The work that I do in terms of the actual negotiations, I work on little slivers of a problem, but to get to a treaty takes 10 or 20 or 30 years to finally resolve these issues. And the entire time, water is being used as a political weapon, and worse, it just can't be managed efficiently. If it's not being managed cooperatively, it's not being managed efficiently. And that means more people are dying, more ecosystems are being degraded, and it's used all the time as a weapon against the neighbor. The other reason things aren't okay, up till now I've been talking about the international level between two countries. But as you drop in scale, the likelihood of violence goes up. And if you think about that, the disincentives to get involved in an international dispute are pretty high. But as you drop in scale, states, for example, in India on the Kaveri River, two states have been fighting each other for decades on that base. And as you drop even further, we have conflicts in southern Oregon, and two farmers we'll shoot at each other almost happily, it seems like, to figure out when one gate will open up and when another closes up. And the last strategic reason I think things aren't okay, remember those numbers I gave you in the beginning, how many people are suffering and dying as a consequence? That's a stability issue. That's a security issue. And these are countries here, the blue areas, heavily irrigated areas, where the pink countries identified are where heavily irrigated areas are losing their water, either through overpumping or lack of quality. And so if you think, for example, in North China Plain, when you start to run out, the rural community runs out of irrigation water, what do you do? What are your choices? Find more water, which they're trying to do, bring water from southern China, huge, vast, expensive project, or stop farming. What do you do if you stop farming? You move, okay? So you move, you adapt. What's your third option? Suffer and die. Those are basically your three options when you run out of water. And what most people try and do is move, right? If you move, who's moving? Single angry men moving where? Into the cities that don't have the infrastructure to absorb them. And that's a stability concern. That's a stability issue, especially if you note, for example, the current situation that flows out of Syria. Syria's in the fifth year of a drought. That was centered precisely in Homs and Hama, precisely the area where all this current discord started. Precisely with this mechanism, people moving to these cities because they didn't have water, bread prices are going up, people start to get really unhappy, and this becomes a security concern. So if you look now at these countries, these are all countries high up on our security agenda. What it means is that it's not so much big issues of war and peace that'll help resolve our issues, but rather the much more nuanced and important process of poverty alleviation. This means if we want a more stable, secure world, we have to think about the rural poor. And we have to help in ways that are much more nuanced than the big war and peace types of issues. So we're now faced in the literature now, if you read about the problem of international waters, there's kind of two schools of thought. One says all these problems are getting worse, leading to human suffering, death, ecosystem degradation. And therefore, it doesn't matter what's happened in the past. In the future, we'll have cross-border violence and war. But the flip side has also been shown to be true, that all of this degradation and all of this suffering leads to tensions, and conflicts do what conflicts do. Conflicts draw resources. They draw attention. They draw creativity. People get interested when there is a conflict, and it's because of that interest that oftentimes we're able to have that second part of the story, where we're able to have the negotiations, the creativity, the resolution that we all look for. And so this term environmental peacemaking is one I'm really attracted to. You use the fact that people share rivers in order to induce conversations, even if they won't talk about other sets of issues. So I just wanted to give you this as kind of background, some of the current issues we're dealing with. We're trying to keep an eye 3 to 5 years into the future. Where are the future flashpoints? We have a huge database of I won't bore you, it's a big database. And with it, we're trying to identify the future hotspots around the world. And Southeast Asia, the Nile Basin, Central Asia, these are all areas that we're watching. This is I wish I could claim this graphic. Popular Science used our data to do this graphic, and I really appreciate that they did it. Apparently, there's a big old basin up here, the Yukon, that has a certain amount of issues related to it. We also try and figure out within, if we're talking about conflict, oftentimes it's much more nuanced than, oh, the Mekong is in conflict. And so if you break down the sets of issues, oftentimes understanding a system better helps to lead to resolution. So we did some work in the Mekong Basin identifying hotspots. Here's a couple of dams going up, actually quite a few dams going up in China. And we're used to thinking if you dam up a river, there's going to be big downstream impacts. And a lot of people were really, really concerned about this. How many people have been there, Mekong Basin, Southeast Asia? Okay, what's the what's the driving weather pattern in Southeast Asia? It's the monsoon, right? So this is actually most of the flow of the basin is driven not from the north, the headwaters, Lake here, but from the south by the monsoon. And so there was actually some modeling done that showed those dams weren't having the impact. And the opposite, they could actually benefit the downstream countries in the dry season. But it's very, very tenuous situation. That Tonle Sap, that big lake there, in the lower level, people who know, it's a really interesting part of the world. During the monsoon, the river's higher than the lake, and the water, the river flows from the river to the lake. And then in the dry season, that whole river reverses flow, and it takes all that waste out of the lake and down into the delta. Fascinating system, but hugely, hugely fragile, and you don't know what the tipping point is going to be to where that kind of system can break. We're also trying to look at water underlying other sets of issues. So we all have a certain interest in Afghanistan. Almost 100% of Afghanistan is within transboundary rivers. And so as we're trying to do whatever it is we're trying to do there, among other things, we're trying to encourage agriculture that's not poppy related. And these other crops are often thirstier than poppies. And so Afghanistan slowly is using more and more water. And if you look on that western border, who's downstream? Iran, right? So basically we're in a situation where to resolve these issues, we need some dialogue between Afghanistan, Iran, and the United States. And that's not an easy dialogue to have, even to find a way to do that. But it's hugely important. This is that top row there is Afghanistan from the international basin perspective. And so whatever is happening in Afghanistan also has reaches as far as China, Central Asia, all through that basin. Everybody's connected to everybody else through these watersheds. Close to home, we're renegotiating our 1964 agreement with Canada, which is also hugely interesting. Canada has been storing our floodwater since 1964. We appreciate it. We've been generating hydropower together. And we ignored entirely ecosystems and tribal rights. And so now the question is, how do we start to incorporate both tribes and their rightful place at the table and ecosystem health into a treaty that's pretty much fixed in place? So the lessons I want to kind of summarize. First of all, to do this work, you got to know water and you got to know process, right? Water alone doesn't help. My first job, as I mentioned, was as a hydrogeologist. My first project, any USGS people here? Good. So this is going on the radio, isn't it? Oh, no. Love the USGS. So my first job was actually US Geological Survey in Wisconsin. And my first task as a scientist, there was a cranberry bog that had a pesticide spill. And there was a plume of pesticides that was moving through the groundwater from the bog to a municipal well close by. And the municipality hired us to figure out when would the plume hit the well. And so as a federal agency, we did what we're asked. When does the plume hit the well? Well, we went out and did a bunch of research and coring and modeling and found out the plume would hit the well somewhere between 5 years from now and 50,000 years from now. And the groundwater people are going, good for you, four orders of magnitude, that's awesome, right? And for groundwater, that is pretty awesome, but for policy, it's not useful at all. And we knew that going into it, right? We answered the question that we were asked instead of, what do we do? And the what do we do could have cost them $5,000 instead of what it did, is you put an observation well between the plume and the well, and if that plume ever hits the observation well, then you change your water supply. That's the answer. So it's understanding both. You gotta know the hydrology to get where the problems are and to look for the nuanced solutions, but you also gotta know process. And here's some examples. This was it's actually a private suggestion to build, bring water from the Tigris-Euphrates to the Jordan. Remember, the Jordan ran out of water, and they thought this would be a really nice solution. And as it flows over the Golan Heights, it could act as an anti-tank barricade between Syria and Israel. And so if you look at those heights there, it's a 3-meter deep canal. Each of these anti-tank barriers are, 100 meters wide. That's a football field wide. And 18 meters high, right? So if you cost this out, first of all, if you do your due diligence and cost this out, you irrigate with this water, you're going to have to charge about $500 for a tomato because you just can't pay for itself. But the other question that they didn't ask was, well, if you need an anti-tank barricade, why would one side let the water flow through their territory? And if you don't, why do you need the anti-tank barricade? Right? So it's understanding the nuance of both sides. I talked a little bit about Central Asia. Here there's in Tajikistan. Tajikistan wants to build the biggest dam in the world. And downstream, Uzbekistan says, if you build this dam, we're going to go to war. And a lot of the documents, this is one that I got involved with, and a lot of the official and even unofficial documents were really concerned about this issue of the impact of the dam on the downstream riparian. And you couldn't possibly build this dam without impacting the growing season downstream, but it takes a water person to look a little closer. That dark blue in the top right is where the dam's going in. There are two dams down below. And so those two dams can be managed as regulating dams, so it doesn't matter as long as you have an agreement. They can do what they want with the first dam as long as you have an agreement on what to do with the other two. And so, again, understanding the nuance of both, and there are some places that have done this really well. When the peace talks started between Israel and the Arabs in the 1990s, there were two tracks to the peace talks. One was the bilateral issues, the high politics of sovereignty and flags and territory and so forth, and then the multilateral, what they call the low political issues, the water resources, environment, refugees, arms control, development. These were multilateral. And out of these five, only water survives to this day. But what they did, when they actually thought about these two, the high politics and the low politics working together, for years they did exactly that. Any advance in one helped influence the other, and so they were greased in a way that they moved forward on a parallel track as long as they could, and then they didn't. But water still survives, and so regardless of everything else going on, the water group from the multilaterals continues to work together. The other lesson, if you get stuck on a problem, make it bigger. A lot of times, it's just the dam and everybody's focusing on it, or it's just the plume and everybody's focusing on it. And an example, again, a dam in Ethiopia. Ethiopia's building a huge dam also, Grand Renaissance Dam. Downstream, Egypt is a little concerned. They've been relying on the water since, time immemorial. And they're deeply concerned. And if you only focus on that dam and those two countries, then sure, there's going to be an impact. But if you broaden out and you look at the Nile as a whole, two things happen. One, even if you're just looking at water, oftentimes there are trade-offs. So more efficiency in Sudan on the White Nile would actually make up losses on the Blue Nile. And so it's fairly easy to transition, and Egypt wouldn't feel the difference at all. So broadening out our geographic scope helps. But even bigger, if you're stuck on water, broaden it out. And that's what they're trying to do on the Nile, is add a basket of benefits, including energy, hydropower development, and road networks, and flights, and banking, and all kinds of other things. And if you build a basket big enough, at some point, everybody is benefiting through the basket. And that's basically what we did with the U.S. and Canada on the Columbia Basin, is we figured out hydropower generation and flood control, figured out how much that is in dollars, and we just divided it 50-50 between the two. People matter is another lesson. We talk about countries as if they're some kind of autonomous monoliths, and we know they're not. All of these problems and all of the solutions are small groups of people in a room trying to have a conversation. And that's where about a third of my work is as a facilitator or a mediator, trying to understand how to see things from each other's perspectives and how to have a conversation that meets everybody's needs. And just give you a quick example, just two guys, David Lilienthal and Dwight Eisenhower, how much influence they've had in our current world of hydropolitics. Eisenhower, just after World War I, anybody know what he took on as his big project? It was transportation. Awesome. He drove across the country, drove across the U.S. in a convoy, in a military convoy in 1919. Anybody want to guess his average speed? 1919? Say again? 5 miles an hour. How do you know that? What are you teaching kids in Alaska? How do you do that? That's exactly right. 5 miles. How do you know that?
I read a lot.
You must. 5 miles an hour. So Eisenhower gets hooked. He suddenly sees that this is his first foray into using big technology to solve human scale problems. He then becomes the force behind the road network, interstate road network in the U.S. And then later, of course, he becomes gets enamored of things like the Tennessee Valley Authority and taps David Lilienthal, comes out of Illinois, farm guy, lawyer, and Lilienthal, his ethic is he wants to use technology to help people. He's kind of a borderline socialist, and he's thinking, I mean, if you think about the Tennessee Valley Authority, it is a huge socialist project right in the middle of the U.S. heartland. And so, and it does this. It's simply motivated at the time by bringing people out of poverty, bringing electricity to the people. And these two guys, one using technology for the big kind of strategic issues, and one using technology for kind of human scale issues, they build up the Tennessee Valley Authority. And both David Ben-Gurion sends envoys to see how it works, to see if it could be applied to the Jordan. Invites Lilienthal, and he comes and writes two reports, one Tennessee Valley Authority on the Indus and Tennessee Valley Authority on the Jordan, and both of these then become the frameworks for the current Treaty of Peace between both Israel and Jordan and India and Pakistan. It's kind of interesting when you look back. He had Operation Candor. He wanted to use this. He's really excited by nuclear power. Students don't remember this, I don't remember this, but apparently in the 50s and 60s, nuclear power was going to save the world. Energy was going to be too cheap to meter, and all our problems go away, right? If you can desalinate, if you can irrigate, if you can transport things without cost, all the world's problems go away. And so he suggested that, developing a peaceful use of nuclear energy, and suggested two reactors, one in, think of this in today's world, Pakistan and Iran. These were the two things. But then that led later to a Water for Peace program. And this is right after the 1967 war. Again, this was Eisenhower at the time, a private citizen. Lilienthal was the first head of the Atomic Energy Commission. That's Alvin Weinberg, who was the head of the Oak Ridge National Labs at the time. And there was a proposal for 5 nuclear desalination plants in the Middle East. Arabs and Israelis came to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is right after the Six-Day War, to see whether this was viable. Of course, they thought it was viable. Surprisingly, there were a couple of folks in the U.S. military that thought sending nuclear energy to this region just after the Six-Day War was probably not a very healthy idea for anybody. Finally, education matters. As I said, to do this stuff, you got to know both. You got to know process. You got to know water. There's only 4 programs that do this explicitly in the world, and we're one of them. There's only one other in the U.S. at Tufts. UNESCO IHE is in the Netherlands. East Anglia in Great Britain. We're really excited. Students, jot this down, because when you get to college, this is the program you want to do. We're just developing a joint program with the University of Peace in Costa Rica, Oregon State, UNESCO IHE, a joint program of water cooperation and peace. And you start in Costa Rica, right? Who wouldn't want to start in Costa Rica to learn all about kind of these high political issues and diplomacy skills? Then you go to Delft in the Netherlands in the winter. Okay, you guys are used to it. This will be a breeze. And then you come to Oregon in the summer, which is a spectacular place to do some kind of a practicum. So all in all, final conclusions, high or low politics, yes. Political scientists get very caught up on this issue, which has to come before which, and the answer is they have to work together. Altruistic champions help, and a lot of times you get folks like Eisenhower or Lilienthal, people all over the world who really see this as a vehicle for peacemaking, a process thoughtful about both high political and how they interact, and of course universities are the center of the universe. And I just want to end here, Kofi Annan, who predicted wars, came around the following year. The water problems of our world need not only be a cause of tension, they can also be a catalyst for cooperation. If we work together, a secure and sustainable water future can be ours. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Wolf will be taking questions, and we have a roving mic, and because it's being recorded, we want you to wait until you're recognized with the microphone before you do ask the question. For those of you who need to depart right at the 1 o'clock hour, feel free to do so. Just do so quietly. And so with that, Dr. Wolf, we'll invite you back to the podium to answer some questions.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, ma'am.
One of the topics that I don't think you addressed was the business of water. Mm-hmm. And one figure sort of came to my attention recently that water, bottled water, is the third largest industry. Now, it wasn't clear in terms of I think it's in relationship to Coke, to Nestle's, to Pepsi.
That's right.
Considering that water is our most precious food, and we have droughts in California, we have water up here, but even here it's beginning to dry up. So what do you know about that?
Well, what I know is what you suggest. It's a huge industry, and I think more and more people are becoming aware that paying a dollar a bottle for something that you can get for free, all close to free out of your tap, is not a good idea economically, not a good idea. It's not any better water, and it has this waste product at the end. And so certainly, I don't know how it is here, but certainly in my world, in a meeting like this, you'd never see bottled water. You just wouldn't. People don't do it anymore. Having said that, I gotta say that all those countries that you mentioned all now have, probably through a certain amount of shaming, big water programs. So Coke, Nestle, Pepsi, all have programs to help get water to out into rural communities. You think about it, I mean, it boggles your mind. I at one point, I'm still really interested in how indigenous people resolve water issues. And I found myself up in the high Atlas Mountains, miles from anything, no roads, no electricity, no anything. And I come to basically a pile of stones that was their local store. Couldn't get water to drink, but you could get a cold can of Coke. And it boggles your mind as you realize their distribution network. Now, if you start to tap into that and use that to help get the things that people need, medicines, water, things like that, they can be terrific allies in this set of issues. But it involves constantly raising precisely the issues that you raise.
Yeah.
Sure, and I'll say it into the mic, yeah.
What concerns me about it is that if we have an industry that is obviously making almost as much water, I mean money on water as on Coke and Pepsi and so forth, what concerns me is that we have corporations that in a sense, you know, they expand.
Yeah.
So controlling water.
It's huge.
You know, for business, but also you're controlling it for private entities. So
yeah. Yeah.
Is anybody paying any attention?
Yeah.
I don't think so it's a very valuable commodity.
Sure.
It's getting more valuable with global warming.
So the question I'm just going to really quickly summarize is that when you're making more money off of water than you are off your soft drinks, and water itself becomes a critical resource to your product, don't we then have to shift the focus and think about things like managing water for private profits? And that's true. And yes, there's a number of people who are concerned about this. Now, having said that, again, it doesn't matter whether you're making a can of Coke or a bottle of water. You still need water for it. And so this is not a particularly new problem, and it's something that people are really concerned about. And there's a lot of places where one of these companies has gone in to try and get access to the water supply that was being used for agriculture, was being used for traditional uses, and is trying to tap into it. So I think now that we're becoming more globally aware of these types of issues, we're also more mobilized to help have more effective conversations. Yeah.
Yes, thank you for your comments. Comment and a question. You were talking about resolving conflicts peacefully or at least without military intervention in water. And I was thinking, it seems to me in the last year there was at least one episode where there was potential military conflict because of the dam in Iraq it was really a power question,
correct,
a power issue, I think. That if Iraq lost control of that dam, the theory was they could lose control over potential electrification for Baghdad and much of the country, as well as the water resources.
Yep.
I guess my question is, being originally you're spending a lot of time in California, if you have any thoughts on the future of water rights within the Southwest and California and the other states and the approaches that are either being taken there or are going to be needed given the shortages and given the various uses of water in that region, and then, of course, with northern Mexico as well.
Sure, thank you. It's a great both comment and question, and you're right. There was dams have always been strategic resources, and people treat them as strategic resources. And they were recently. It's actually two dams in Iraq that there was some fight over control. And you're right. It wasn't about the water. It was about access to the power generation. It was access to the electricity grid. So for places like California. I grew up there, and you know, water, our feeling was it just went away, right? You used it once. I didn't know where it came from. I didn't know where it went. I know that L.A. was bad because they wanted our water, but I didn't really understand the nuance of what that meant. Sorry to Angelinos here in the room. If you looked at places that have kind of dealt with California-level droughts, decades ago. So there are three that come to mind, focusing particularly in the developed world. Israel, Singapore, and Australia. All of these hit these kind of levels long ago. And what they did, they made the difficult decisions that California is now having to make, is that water doesn't go away. It's not a free good. It requires real care, and that you have to use it not just for its most efficient use once, but as you recycle it over and over and over, you use it for its most efficient use all the way down the line. And so if you put in parallel Israel's water network and California's, California, with some investment, can go an awful long way. What they would have to do is think about things like groundwater recharge. They would have to think about recycling. They would have to think about the water rights and the most efficient use for water. Israel uses every single drop 4 or 5 times before it's finally released into the sea. And they have two parallel distribution networks. This is hugely expensive. They have a blue network for fresh water and then reclaimed water. They have an entire reversible network in parallel running reclaimed water only for agriculture. And then after agriculture, you take that waste and you use it for cooling and industry. So this is basically what astronauts do on a shuttle. They don't run out of water. You just have to invest a lot of money and a lot of thought into its best use. And that'll happen. They said in the water world, you say every drought is always 1 year too short, because just when you're about to make the real painful decisions, both laws and technology and investment, it starts to rain, and then everything goes to hell. In this particular drought, I don't think it's going to rain anytime soon, and I do think California is going to have to make some of these really, really tough choices. Fortunately, there are these three examples of how to do it really, really well.
Yes, I know when the issue was with Lake Powell, mm-hmm. One of the problems people were concerned about is about the losing water actually through evaporation,
yeah, right.
And also in fish use, in the rocks. What do you have to say about, because you talked a lot about dams, instead of concern?
Yeah. Yeah, of course it's a concern. In an arid area, every loss is concern. Again, I keep feeling myself fall into mediator mode because I see everybody's side. That whole part of the world kind of relies heavily on the hydropower that's generated at Lake Powell. So the question always is, can you do it more efficiently? Can you do it more effectively? Lake Powell's there. It's not going anywhere, and the water's going to continue to evaporate, and it's going to seep into the cracks. The cracks actually is less of an issue because that shows up as groundwater at some point. It's not in the lake, but it's still part of the local system, and then is pumped out at some point through groundwater wells. So I think there's a really good example. If we look at one point in the system, it's really easy to get frustrated and oh, look at all the loss. If you look at the system as a whole, what I would urge us to do is think at systematically, are there places for more efficiencies? I think we're becoming a lot better at building dams now than we were when Lake Powell was built. We're getting more thoughtful about things like ecosystems, like resettlement, like evaporation, like, and I don't think that if we were doing it now that we would have built that dam. So I'm not one, again, because I'm a mediator, I have to mediate fairly to all the people in the room. I can't say in my mind I'm against all dams all the time, ever in the future. I think certainly in the U.S. we've built as many dams as we can and need to. And two, if there are going to be dams, we want to be a lot more careful about where we put them and how we build them than we were in the past.
Last question.
This is somewhat of a follow-up question to the earlier one about Lower 48, but have you looked at historically how different parts of the world and the rest of the United States have looked at Alaska as a source of water because of it having the lion's share of the nation's water, as well as most of it at this point in time in our early stage of infancy, not committed, and the Alaska water export law that was passed in 92 as a basis to try to avoid many of the problems that most other people don't have the luxury of avoiding?
Yep. That's actually why I'm here. I'm scoping it out. There's always going to be people who want to do stuff like that, bring water from far, far away. And the truth of the matter is, again, if you're thoughtful and you cost it out, there's dozens of ways to increase efficiencies within the area that's in drought. So if you took California, if you costed out a pipeline from here to there, and you thought about anything else, including desalination, better toilets, better showers, drip irrigation, more thoughtful use, recycling, all of these are more cost efficient than bringing water from Alaska. The trick about water is that it's heavy. This is a cubic meter of water, and that weighs a metric ton. And you can't move it without investing hugely in energy. And if you're going to invest in energy anyway, and you got an ocean sitting there, it's a lot easier to desalinate from the ocean than it is to try and get around a bunch of irate Alaskans. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you all very much.